Dwight graduated from Brigham Young University in 1975. So let's give a warm welcome to Mark and Dwight.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege and a great opportunity to be here today. First of all, do we have any winners in here from the drawing? I saw someone walk in. Did anyone put like gum on your card? Was that nothing? No, you didn't? Okay. Now remember, this is an ethics course in here. So we want to make sure everything is great. Dwight and I, as has been mentioned, we're from the Special Investigations Unit. Whoops, wrong button. Here we go. From Select Health. And in the Special Investigations Unit, we investigate all types of fraud and abuse when it comes to insurance claims. And we'll talk about today the different types of insurance fraud that we come across, and also some problems that have happened in the agencies, and what you can do as agents and brokers and producers to help curtail this epidemic that's going on in the world today. We're here to talk about ethics and leadership. And we first, in order to talk about it, we got to find out what we're talking about. So the definition of ethics, we've come across some ideas. And when you talk of ethical behavior, you think of trustworthiness, you think of honesty, you think of being fair, refusing to take unfair advantage of people or of situations, preventing harm, concern for the well-being of others, a moral duty and obligation, and excellence in your conduct and in your behavior. And I think all of these roll up to one, come to the conclusion of professional standards, that you have that professional standard in your business life and in your personal life. And that's what we're really here to do, is make sure that we maintain that those ethical standards. A couple quotes that came across, this one I always like, it's by William Penn, and he said, "Right is right, even if everyone is against it, and wrong is wrong, even if everyone's for it." And I think in today's society, we can see that there's a lot of people out there that go by this philosophy of, you know, hey, it's wrong, but hey, I can do it. Another thing George Washington said, "I hope I shall always possess the firmness and virtue enough to maintain what I consider the most enviable of all titles, that being the character of an honest man." Now, we talk about the word ethics. Where does that word ethics come from? Well, the word comes from the Greek word ethos, meaning character, and the word from Latin mores, meaning customs. So the two of these combine together define how individuals choose to interact with one another. And I think that's the whole key, is how we interact with one another and what kind of behavior. And we'll go into more detail towards the end on this aspect. But when we talk about ethical behavior, unfortunately, there's people that have unethical behavior, and that means fraud. And what is the definition of fraud? Does anyone know what's the legal definition of fraud? Anyone? Anyone know? Yeah. Theft by deception. It's close, but the key element to this is the intentional deception or misrepresentation, that when an individual or entity makes, knowing that the misrepresentation can result in some type of unauthorized benefit to that person or entity. In other words, the key here is the intentional act. That is the key. Now, lack of that in the health insurance industry, we talk about healthcare abuse. And healthcare abuse is any activity that abuses the healthcare system but does not meet that statutory definition that we just talked about. And this kind of encompasses overutilization, changing procedure codes, and unbundling services. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But in order to see if there is a problem, in the year 2005, It is estimated by the National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association that approximately $1.9 trillion was paid for healthcare services. Now, that's a lot of money. And they estimate that 3% of that money, or $58 billion, was associated to fraud. Now, I don't know about you, but $58 billion could really help in my healthcare premium and lower the cost of healthcare to us in the United States. The National Insurance Crime Bureau, they estimate approximately $30 billion a year and can average as much as $300 to the average insurance premium for a household. I've seen estimates as low as 1%, and I've seen estimates as high as 10%. And in fact, the Insurance Research Council, they estimate that approximately, in addition to this, $5 billion is fraudulent in auto claims. And I came from the auto industry before I came to IHC, and it's unbelievable the amount of staged accidents and embellishing of injuries in order to get a larger settlement. I'm sure, do we have any attorneys in here?
One call, that's all.
I wasn't going to say. But the phone book attorneys, it's amazing, you know, how they pray. I don't know about you guys who've been home in the afternoon and how many advertisements there are for people to make claims. It's unbelievable. But is there a problem? I say yes. In fact, we found out that back in 1965, Hollywood decided that there was a problem, and they made a movie about it.
Morning, Harry.
How did I get here?
By stretcher and ambulance.
Oh, my head. What did they give me?
Whole gang of sleeping pills.
Where's the can?
Forget it. You can't get out of bed.
Wait, I can't go. Who says?
Hate to break it to you, kid, but you got a spinal injury.
What?
Your left leg is numb and you got no feeling in the first three fingers of your right hand.
Well, you're crazy. I can move my hand and my leg.
Sure you can, if you want to blow $1 million.
$1 million? What are you talking about?
That's what we're suing for. They'll offer us $100,000. We settle for $250,000.
I got to go to the camp.
There we are. I'll bring it to you.
What are you trying to pull? I'm perfectly all right.
There's one thing I hate. It's a patient who makes his own diagnosis.
This is ridiculous. There's nothing wrong with me.
That's what you think. Not only can't you move your hand and your leg, but you had this concussion. So now you got a ringing in your ears and double vision.
Double vision.
How many me do you see?
One. One cheap, chiseling, shyster lawyer who, of all people, had to marry my sister.
Nice talk. I'm handing you $250,000 on a silver platter.
Don't want the money. Don't want the silver platter.
What's the matter? You feel sorry for insurance companies? They got so much money, they don't know what to do with it. They've run out of storage space. They have to microfilm it. What's $250,000 to them? They take it out of petty cash. So don't give me with the scruples.
You can see, even back in 1965, that people wanted to enhance their income by taking the money away from the big bad insurance companies. But people don't realize that the quote big bad insurance companies are made up of everyone that's here in this room and here today. We're the ones that pay the premiums. We're going to talk about some types of healthcare fraud. First one we're going to talk about is member or consumer fraud. Then we're going to talk about healthcare provider fraud and agent and broker fraud. And what we want to talk about primarily is what is the producer, the agent broker's role in helping to mitigate healthcare fraud. And in order to do that, we want to show you what some of the elements of fraud are in these different areas. And then at the end, we'll show you how we can all work together in order to overcome this epidemic that's hitting us today.
The wolf in sheep's clothing. Let's go ahead and talk about some of the different kinds of member fraud. We're going to start with prescription fraud. Let me just say this. This is a huge problem nationwide. This is the way that so many people believe they can get their drugs, their narcotics, legally by going to an emergency room. We get information from the Department of Professional Licensing, from emergency room records, even from families who will tell us that they have a family member who's really abusing the system. Let me give you an example. We recently had a case of a young gal who really couldn't figure out a better way to get her her drugs. So during a five-month period, she went to the emergency room umpteen times. She had emergency room bills of over $65,000 in a five-month period in an effort to get medications, narcotics, and basically during that five-month time got about $300 worth of injectable drugs. But the drain she put on the emergency rooms of those hospitals, the amount of claims that were being submitted to the insurance company, a huge problem, and it goes on all over the country. Oxycontin, as you probably are very aware, is a very popular drug of choice on the street and in the home. You may have seen some of the reports lately about robberies that were going on at different pharmacies, with OxyContin being the number one target for those robberies. Let me share with you some information about a huge OxyContin ring that was going on in Salt Lake and surrounding counties. When this ring was finally brought down, there were 234 people involved in it. They were patients, there were runners, there were cappers, there were all kinds of people involved in it. The way it worked is there was a doctor at the very head of this organization, and he would charge $400 to $500 for an office visit for an individual to come in with the express purpose of getting a prescription for OxyContin. Now, they were looking for people who had insurance benefits that would cover OxyContin prescriptions. These people would go to the doctor, get their prescriptions, go to the pharmacy, fill the prescriptions, and then come back to the doctor. If they could afford the fee of $400 to $500 for the original visit, they would make that payment and they could keep their OxyContin. If they couldn't afford the fee, then they had to give the doctor or his people 75% of those OxyContin tablets, and they could keep 25% of them. This thing got so big and so well organized that it was even cutting into the heroin traffic of some local street gangs. And so they wanted a piece of the action. They were also involved then in distributing OxyContin tablets. They became vicious and used phone calls to intimidate and threaten people if they didn't cooperate and didn't do what they wanted them to do. Finally, investigators were able to take this down, and they did a little research as to how many tablets this doctor was prescribing and where he stood with his peers. A review of all of the OxyContin prescriptions that were made during this time period, which was January of 2004 to early 2005, the next highest prescriber of OxyContin had prescribed approximately 8,400 tablets, 8,400. This particular doctor prescribed almost 75,000 tablets in just over a year for this ring. So it was a huge problem and caused no end of grief to law enforcement, to pharmacies, to insurance companies, and to people that were involved and closely related to this. We also have the information regarding medical and pharmacy personnel fraud. We're aware of some pharmacies around the country that will fill any prescription, no questions asked. Basically, it's one for you and one for me. And it goes on way too often. Another area is where we have the insured and a provider working together for the benefit of each other. This, you may recognize, is basically an insole arch support that podiatrists, for example, prescribe all the time. They're always using these. And then this is what is called an ankle-foot orthotic, or an AFO. The newer models will have straps and Velcro and whatnot, but it does basically the same thing as this picture. Most insurance companies will not cover the arch support. In fact, I don't know of a single company that does. But they will cover an ankle-foot orthotic. So we had a podiatrist who decided, if I'm going to be giving out all of these arch supports that are not covered, how am I going to get reimbursed for this? So he decides, well, I'll just go ahead and bill an AFO, and the insurance company will never know. Well, he's currently making restitution payments of almost $380,000 because the insurance company did find out. A complete lack of ethics in that case. Then you have collusion with providers. Services that are not medically necessary, but the member and the provider will work together to document the necessity of the procedure that they want to have covered by the insurance company. Another one is where the diagnosis is changed by the doctor or his staff to a covered benefit in order to get their claim paid. Now, these two are quite possibly the most common types of fraud that we see. Foreign claims, I don't even know where to start with foreign claims. We have such a difficult time trying to find out if foreign claims are legitimate or not that we basically have the impression that we'll start from the point of view that any foreign claim is full of fraud. And then we'll work from there and see if we can't find out what is really going on. Let me share one with you here. Authorities from the United States, from Canada, and from Mexico recently shut down a clinic that was operating in Mexico that was purporting to treat cancer patients with magnets. They had this new technology. They had a Zoetron machine. It had powerful magnets that would cure your cancer. Unfortunately, these are the kinds of clinics that prey on desperate people, people who have terminal illnesses, and they are targeting the most vulnerable part of our society. These people are looking for any kind of hope they can. They see an ad, they hear about some clinic that promises to help them, so they will go. Not only are the treatments bogus, but then they compound the problem by billing insurance companies for other kinds of procedures that would normally be covered by the insurance company. They're not telling them what they're really doing, but they're billing for something that would be legitimate. Now, in this one particular case, the Federal Trade Commission did a study of this machine, the Zoetron, and they determined that the power of these magnets was the equivalent of a magnet in a refrigerator. And it was not doing any good whatsoever. This is an interesting slide. These advertisements you can find online all of the time, where they will invite you to come down to paradise to convalesce after a cosmetic surgery. It's kind of interesting. They have these all over South and Latin America, the Caribbean, and they'll even give you some photos of some of the most beautiful hospital rooms you've ever seen. The only way that you can really tell that those might be hospital rooms is it does look like it might be a hospital bed, but I've never seen a hospital room like that. And the views, they're unbelievable. Now, a health insurance company doesn't really care if somebody's going to go down, spend their own money to have some cosmetic surgery, feel good about themselves, whatever, wherever they want to have it done. But the problem occurs when these facilities then bill the insurance company for some other procedure or procedures that would normally be covered, and the records don't indicate whatsoever that it was cosmetic surgery. And then we're in a real bind trying to figure out what really happened. There was a problem down in Southern California, and it still exists today. It was huge a couple years ago, and it's probably just as big, if not bigger now, where there were clinics that would encourage people to come down and to visit their clinic. They would pay their airfare. They would put them up in a hotel. All these people had to do was come down and get a very simple procedure. Normally it was a colonoscopy, which in and of itself is a good thing. They would have them come down. A colonoscopy here in Utah costs $2,500, $3,000 max. These people go to Southern California, have a colonoscopy. While they were there, they would get some cash. Some of them had cosmetic surgery. The facility would bill the insurance companies anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000 for a colonoscopy. Insurance companies were paying millions before they figured out what was going on here. There was another one. They basically referred to it as rent-a-patients. These insurance billing mills, commonly called a clinic, would have people come down and they would perform a lot of different kinds of surgeries. Here's the example of one, Julio Hernandez. Julio, during a 5-month stretch, now he's 36 years old, during 5 months, he lived in Arizona, he would travel to Southern California, he had a circumcision, a removal of his sweat glands, a nose operation, a colonoscopy, and an endoscopy. He readily admits he needed none of these, but every time he went, they gave him $800 in cash. So he felt like he was making a pretty good living having his body used for surgery that was completely unnecessary. He's had health problems ever since. But the insurance companies were billed for well over $100,000 for procedures that were completely unnecessary. So as you can see, the lack of ethics out there on the part of not only providers but of patients is unbelievable, and it's a continuing problem for the healthcare industry. This is an article in the Wall Street Journal talking about the FBI and several raids that they made in Southern California on several of these clinics that were billing for all manner of procedures. Now, Mark and I try to conduct our investigations face-to-face with as many people as we can. We like to talk to them face-to-face. If you think about it, it's a lot easier to lie to somebody on the phone than it is to lie to somebody in person. Body language sometimes just shouts out that this isn't true. Little mannerisms come out, all kinds of things. So we like to keep our interviewing techniques current, practice, and we'd like to share with you a training video that we think is very helpful, and it may help you as you try to deal with your customers and clients and making sure that as you talk to them, you're getting the full truth.
This is the city. Los Angeles, California. Some people rob for pleasure. Some rob because it's there. You never know. My name's Friday. I'm a cop. I was working the day watch out of robbery when I got a call from the Acme School Bell Company. There'd been a robbery.
There's been a robbery.
Yes, sir. What was it?
My clappers.
Your clappers?
Yeah, you know those things inside a bell that makes them clang?
The clangers.
That's right. We call them clappers in the business.
A clapper caper.
What's that?
Nothing, sir. Now, can I have the facts? What kind of clappers were stolen on this caper?
They were copper clappers.
And where were they kept?
In the closet.
Uh-huh.
You have any ideas who might have taken the copper clappers from the closet?
Well, just one. I fired a man. He swore he'd get even.
What was his name?
Claude Cooper.
You think
that,
he...
That's right. I think Claude Cooper copped my copper clappers. Kept in the closet.
You know where this Claude Cooper is from?
Yeah. Cleveland. That figures. That figures. What makes it worse, they were clean.
Clean copper clappers.
That's right.
Why do you think Cleveland's Claude Cooper would cop your clean copper clappers kept in your closet?
Only one reason.
What's that?
He's a kleptomaniac.
Who first discovered the copper clappers were copped?
My cleaning woman. Clara Clifford.
That figures. Now let me see if I got the facts straight here. Cleaning woman Clara Clifford discovered your clean copper clappers kept in a closet were copped by Claude Cooper, the kleptomaniac from Cleveland. Now, is that about it?
One other thing.
What's that?
If I ever catch kleptomaniac Claude Cooper from Cleveland who copped my clean copper clappers from kept in the closet...
Yes?
I'll clobber him.
We haven't perfected our skills to that quality yet, but it's getting there. Well, one thing, we just had a case where we had a lady went down to Mexico, down to Tijuana, and had a tummy tuck done. And she asked him, says, well, how much does it cost me? And he says, well, it doesn't cost you anything. Just give us your insurance card. So she gave us the insurance card, and the insurance company got billed for a ruptured appendix and for an 18-day stay in a hospital and charged the insurance company $32,000. And so she got a free cosmetic surgery, and the insurance company was supposed to pay $32,000, but luckily it got stopped and it hasn't worked. In fact, the FBI has a major investigation going right now with these facilities down south of the border, because it's just going rampant. We want to talk a little bit about dependent eligibility fraud and married dependents. And this is how it all started. There was a young lady who went into a local hospital, and she checked in under her maiden name. And she was there being serviced. She had her little baby. But people kept coming in to visit her and asking for another name. And so the nursing staff were really confused because they have one patient registered under this name, and people are asking for another name. Well, the nurse went up and talked to the patient and said, hey, what's going on here? Who are you? He says, I'll clarify that. He says, see, I checked in under my maiden name so I could be under my mom's insurance policy, but I'm really married, and I'm staying under my mom's policy so the insurance companies can pay for my baby. And she says, you're kidding. He says, you can't do that. She says, the insurance companies will never find out. I've done this twice before. And so needless to say, the nurse picked up the phone, called our hotline, and said, hey, you might want to look into this. So we started investigating, and we started looking at the medical records. And I know this is kind of hard to see because of the projection, but the medical records show, like on this one down here, it'll say HUSB at BS, the husband at bedside. This is a nurse's note that she would write down. And then also what was interesting, we found records that she checked in and said that she was single, and then she also said that she was married. Now, many of us here have teenagers, and when they tell a fib or not tell us the truth, it's hard to remember what they say from one lie to another. But if you tell the truth, it's pretty easy to tell the truth because it's the truth every time. But what happens is people, when they tell a mistruth or an untruth, they tend to get really messed up, and they tend not to be able to tell the same thing the same time after time. And that's what happened here. Well, what happened was that we went and interviewed the mother and the daughter. They admitted what they did. The mother said, the reason I did this is because my daughter and husband don't have any insurance. He's unemployed. And the only way to get the babies paid for is to put them under my plan and say that they were single. Going back to that first slide about the definition of fraud, they had the intent to defraud the insurance company. And so that resulted in felony charges filed against the mother and the daughter. It also resulted in $10,000 in restitution having been paid by the two. The mother lost her job as a result of this, and their coverage was terminated. And so we sat there and looked and said, well, if this is happening here, what's happening to the rest of our population of dependents? So we took all our dependents between the ages of 18 and 26, ran them through a database with the state against their marriage records at the Vital Records Department, and lo and behold, we got hits up to about 3,600 names of dependents that were actually married. So we started working this, and we started working with the state and spreading this to other insurance companies, and it ultimately, the Department of Insurance Fraud, they discovered about 36,000 teenagers or young adults were still on parents' policies that shouldn't be, and approximately $7 million was paid out on these dependents that shouldn't have been there. So then we started thinking, well, if it's happening to dependents on their policy, on their mother and dad's policy, how about divorced spouses that have never been removed off of their the other spouse's policy? So we looked at that, and it was estimated about 17,000 throughout the state fell into that category. We matched through the database with the state with the divorce records, and it was millions of dollars that was affected. In fact, the large corporations throughout the United States started looking into this, and Daimler Chrysler found 27,000 employees who had ineligible family members on their policies, and Ford Motor found approximately 50,000 illegal or ineligible dependents since 2000 on their rolls. And so this was a huge epidemic going back as far as 2003. Just from our association here at Select Health, we were able to recover approximately $1 million just from the dependent marriages. So it really was a big epidemic. And now, through education, through word getting around, that number has greatly diminished. We don't have hardly any people remaining on the policies. People know that I'm supposed to remove my dependent off the policy, and if they do stay on, you don't send them to the ER to have babies and surgeries, etc. The dependents, when we started working on this, when we talked to these people face to face, it was funny. One said, well, my agent told me that I could keep him on, and so I kept him on. Well, they say that because it's really not true, because I know all you agents and brokers and producers know that that's not the case, and you would never say that. And I have not seen one case yet that they say that was the case that happened. It never happened. And so we contact them and get those dependents off. We had another case where I called a mother and said, you know, I was really concerned. Your daughter shows that she was married in February. And she says, no. She got married in August. I said, well, no, the state says she was married in February. She says, nope, the state's wrong. She says, I paid for a huge wedding up at Alta with my daughter. She says, I'll send you the photos of me in the marriage line. She says, I know when my daughter got married because I paid for a huge, huge wedding. And I said, well, we're really concerned here because the state says that she got married in February. Can you go talk to her and find out what happened? Well, she called me back about half hour later and said, you know, I have to apologize. She says, I'm going to kill my daughter. I said, well, why? What happened? She says, well, her boyfriend worked for an airline, and if they're married, the spouse flies free throughout the United States or the world as a spouse. So they went out and got married through a justice of the peace, in February, and they've been flying around the country as husband and wife for the past 6 months. And they then, when they went out on dates, they lived each at each other's, or the parents' homes. They would go on a date, they would go out, and that would be their married time together. And the wife says, or the mother said, "I'm sorry, you know, I spent all this money and it was a big hoax. They were already married." And she says, I'm so sorry. So this went on and on and on. And so the more we talked about this, we thought, well, if this is happening with our children, then what kind of excuses are we going to get when we talk to the divorces? And I kind of took over the marriage problem, and Dwight took over the divorces. And I think he has better excuses that he heard.
In some ways, I've become a divorce expert. But let me share with you some of what a lack of ethics will give to us in an excuse. You would be surprised how many people I have called to find out. We'll match them with the state database on divorces, and then we'll narrow that group down. We'll go through a couple of other sources to try and narrow down even further those numbers, and then we'll make a gentle phone call trying to figure out what happened. Are you really divorced? What's going on here? In more than at least a half a dozen cases, I believe I was the first one to notify these people that they were in fact divorced. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm going to go to the time, the effort, the money, all the trouble to file for a divorce, I'm certainly going to know whether it became final or not. And I don't even want to comment on the problems associated with not knowing you are divorced when it comes to taxes and the IRS, joint loans, and all kinds of other problems that exist. So if you as an agent know the marital status of an individual, make sure you're asking the right questions so that you can elicit the response that's appropriate and that's correct. Another great case here. There was a gentleman that lived back east, and he was married. After a while, he decided he didn't want to be married anymore, filed for a divorce, went before the judge, and the judge said, "You know, I'm sorry I can't help you, wrong jurisdiction, you'll need to go to such and such a place." The guy decided it wasn't worth his time and his effort, so he ignored it, didn't do anything, eventually moved to Utah without his wife and without ever getting the divorce. After he'd been here for a while, decided that he had met the right person to live with the rest of his life, so he got married to her. Now, the insurance companies here and back east were talking to each other and trying to figure out what's going on here. The insurance company back east gets a hold of him. They say, what's the story? Looks like you have two marriages here. What's going on? He says, "Well, here in Utah, you can be married to more than one wife and insure them on your insurance." And of course, the company back there didn't believe him, and so we were able to resolve that issue. But you would be amazed what people will tell us. Another interesting one, a guy's in the hospital for some serious heart problems, and there's a notation in one of the records that he told somebody during the admittance process that he was divorced. So a couple days later, I'm talking to his wife, and I said, can you help me? There's some information from your husband, some kind of a note here, that indicates he's divorced. Are the two of you divorced? Are you married? What's the status? She says, "I don't know why he would say that. We were married in 2003, and there's no reason for me to understand why he would even say that. We're happily married. Life is good." Okay, well, I appreciate that. Thank you. I talk to him the next day. I say, can you help me out here? You told us at one point you were divorced. Is that true? What's the story? He says, no. I don't know why you got that information, but the date of our marriage, Valentine's Day 2004, was the most important date of my life. I will never forget it. It was wonderful. Okay, well, thanks. And I tried to find some sort of documentation that would prove that. I couldn't find it. I went back to him a couple days later. I said, listen, I can't find a record anywhere, state, county. Can you tell me a little bit more about this marriage? He said, well, one thing I didn't tell you is it's probably not recorded anywhere because I didn't get a license. We never recorded with the state. A friend of mine was a deacon. So we just went up into the mountains, and we had a very nice ceremony up in the mountains, and he married us there. I don't think he told anybody, but what's important is that we were married in the eyes of God. And so we're married. Well, needless to say, we didn't feel he was married, nor did the law, so he wasn't eligible for coverage. Let's talk about some definitions here for policy fraud. Obtaining a policy of insurance or a specific coverage by use of false, incomplete, or misleading information when the policy would not otherwise be issued and the coverage would not otherwise be afforded. Some basic elements then would be the applicant provides false, incomplete, or misleading information to the carrier for the purpose of obtaining a benefit not actually entitled to receive. Remember, we talked about that from the get-go, that intentional misrepresentation or deceit. The carrier relies upon the bad information to determine whether to issue a policy or afford coverage. And basically, the policy fraud is contractual fraud, and it voids the contract. Now, let's take that a step further and talk about eligibility fraud. A misrepresentation of the following facts will usually be considered material to the issuance of coverage: family medical history, occupation, lifestyle, and the identity, health, and eligibility status of dependents. Now, this is a copy of an actual benefit election form. If you can see about halfway down there, this man was trying to get benefits, health insurance. So he includes the name, first of all, of a male son. Then the second line is a male son. The next one is a daughter. And then the next one is his wife. Almost as if it was an afterthought. Now, I'm not going to go into that. But normally we see the spouse first and then the children. Then down below is the beneficiary designation. He lists a daughter first as a primary beneficiary, a son as a secondary beneficiary, and never anywhere does he list his wife as a beneficiary. So we did a little checking on this, and sure enough, he had been divorced from his wife, and the name he put on here was his girlfriend. I suppose eventually he was going to get married, but she wasn't entitled to coverage. So misrepresentation must be material, and a good litmus test for that is absent the misrepresentation, the policy would not have been issued or the coverage would not have been afforded. Now, the courts have given us a great test for materiality. A misrepresentation will be considered material if a reasonable insurance company, in determining its course of action, would attach importance to the fact misrepresented. Now, we all know that must be discovered within a period of a couple of years. Beyond that, then it becomes a little gray what will happen. And I'll turn it over to Mark.
Okay. We'll talk about how this really all kind of pertains to the agents and brokers. You know, we came across a saying in the magazine, and I think this puts it all together. It says, the vast majority of insurance agents are like a good neighbor and are on your side, and when you're dealing with them, you're in good hands. And I think, you know, as you put this all together, you know, the insurance agents are there to get the best rates and to make certain that the insurers are paid when there is a claim. But unfortunately, as in any type of profession, there's a couple bad apples. And I'll give you a couple examples of situations that we came across. We had a husband-wife team who took payments from over 300 victims and didn't purchase the insurance, and then they were sentenced to 2 years in prison in order to pay $183,000 in restitution. We had another lady down in Florida that misappropriated approximately $30,000 in workers' comp premiums, never forwarded them on to the insurance company, but she provided binders and proof of insurance to all these people. We also had here in Salt Lake City an agent that sold a business policy to a bar, to an owner of a bar, and unfortunately that bar caught on fire. And the agent, the victim, went to the insurance company and said, "Hey, I have a claim here. I need my bar repaired." And they said, "Well, we're sorry, but you don't have insurance with us." And he goes, "Well, yes, I do. I have a proof of insurance right here," and gave him a binder. Well, the binder, of course, was a forged binder. And it turns out that he was giving his insurance premiums to the agent, and the agent asked them to make the checks payable to him because it would make it a lot easier with the bank. And so the victim, the owner, wrote out the checks to him, approximately $20,000 in premium checks that the agent collected himself and never forwarded on to the insurance company. This person right now has a really nice bed and color TV set at Point of the Mountain. One of the things that happens when we have a rescission of the policy is that it actually voids the policy because the insurance contract is based on a fraudulently secured offer and acceptance. And the carrier at that point must refund all the premiums, and then the insurance company will go back and recollect all those claims. So it's very important that that on the rescission that we go back and do this. I know there are some situations where this doesn't happen, where they just terminate the policy effective that date and don't go back for a rescission. Another couple of situations is twisting. That's when agents persuade an investor to cash in one investment for another against the client's best interest, and it's all solely for the agent's own financial gain. Another one is called slamming. Slamming was pretty much geared towards the telephone companies when they were converting long distance conversion a couple years ago. But this would happen down in Nevada where agents were sending out, it looks like, invoices and renewal notices, which weren't really really legitimate, and the people were paying them. And so what we're trying to do, I know I received a lot of mail, and I get things on from my mortgage company as a return address, and I open it, and it's like, okay, we want you to convert to a different type of mortgage, and it turns out that the actual address is in Irvine, California, and I go, well, my mortgage company is not in California, and it's just a company trying to slam me to get to move my mortgage over to another company. And so this happens all the time. You know, that the agent and brokers are the most underutilized partner in combating insurance fraud, and they are the most valuable investigative tool that we can use if we work together. And so that's what one reason why we're here today is to elicit your help and to work together. If you have questions, feel free to call the insurance company, especially the special investigations units, if you feel you have something that's just not right. Is it yours? Mine? Okay. On the agent broker participation, you are the first contact with those consumers and customers, and you have personal contact with them. You get to know them. You get to know what's going on in the community. You are really less associated with the carrier, but you're more in tune with the customer himself. And what's really, then this last one here, perpetrators must deal with you. You are the frontline defense. They have to deal with you first, and if the hair stands up on the back of your neck and something just isn't right, you need to follow up on that instead of, well, okay, we'll just go ahead and process this.
Okay, let's talk briefly about some of the things that can be done at the agency level regarding fraud prevention. Let's start, first of all, with some of the education that can go on regarding the impact of fraud. You want to make people aware of the dollar impact on your customers, your consumers. That link of fraud to increasing premium rates, the correlation to a tighter profit margin, and to remember that it can happen to your policyholders. The producer's role in fraud mitigation. The producer is on the front line. There's the contact right there. Every component of the insurance industry is interdependent. We need all of us to work together when it deals with fraud and every other area of the industry. The producer is an important component of the overall effort. Fraud mitigation is the responsibility of all of us. You have a conversation with somebody as you're writing a policy and it just doesn't make sense, it doesn't sound right, ask those questions that need to be asked. The SIU can only be as effective as each of the other component allows. Training on the agency level, in agency presentations, agent association presentations, situations similar to this, face-to-face visits. And don't be afraid to utilize claim investigations to illustrate the different kinds of things that you're concerned about and you want your consumers, your clients, to be aware of. And then the producer as a fraud prevention partner reinforces the ethical behavior at the policy's very inception. And it discourages soft fraud, it deters hard fraud, and the intelligence you develop as you deal with these people will be helpful to you in the long run. And you are carrying the anti-fraud message to the very grassroots, to where it all begins. The same questions that discourage perpetrators help producers get to know their customers and to better identify and understand their customers' needs. Honest consumers appreciate efforts to reduce fraud losses. And our feeling is applicants who object to questions probably have something to hide. When there is a concerted effort at the agency, perpetrators will tend to go away. The producer is perceived as caring about his customers. And any business discouraged by fraud prevention practices was probably bad business in the first place. Now let's kind of finish up here with ethics and leadership. History and surveys and all kinds of information gathered really points out that subordinates will give almost any deficiency in their leaders except for the lack of integrity. Now, I think there's a direct correlation between our colleagues, our business associates, and our ethical behavior. And certainly, there's a connection between our ethical behavior and our clients, our consumers, our customers. One thing that I want to remind you of is that ethical behavior is not confined to a legal code. It's really on a higher plane than codified law. Let me give you one quick brief example. Lying or betraying the confidence of a close friend. It's not necessarily illegal, but it is certainly unethical. So let's take ethics to a higher level. Now, as you deal with your clients, your customers, And as all of us deal with the public, and we need to be concerned about customer relations. Sometimes we need to think outside of the box. We need to do things that maybe this is not the way I've always done it, but it might be the best way to do it. Do something a little different. We'd like to show you a brief training video segment that I think will point out the importance of thinking outside of the box.
Enjoy your flight, thanks. Hello. Oh, I'm sorry. We're only boarding rows 9 and above right now. You'll have to wait.
I'm in row 8.
Please step aside, sir.
It's just one row. Don't you think it's okay if I...
We'll call your row momentarily. Step aside, sir. Thank you for waiting. We'd like to continue boarding the aircraft now. We're now boarding all rows, please. All remaining rows. Hello. Enjoy your flight.
Now, while that may have been extreme, it does point out the fact that sometimes we need to do things a little differently than we've always done, perhaps, in taking care of the consumer, our clients, our customers. But in doing so, we don't throw ethics out the window. We remember the ethical behavior that we have been taught, that we believe in, that we profess, and we can still help our customers in any way possible. I've put up on the board here the contact numbers for Mark and for myself. If you ever have any questions or anything that we might be able to help you with, feel free to contact us. If you see something that just doesn't smell right, feel free to call the SIU for the company you work for. If you're Select Health, feel free to give us a call. We appreciate being here with you today and wish you the best of luck. Thank you.
Thank you.
We will be down here in front if you have any questions or comments. We'd be happy
now,
to talk to you.
This is the brownie break.
Yeah, make it
so
quick.
This is the BYU brownie break. You want to make sure you get those.
We'd like to give you a token of our appreciation.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very
much. Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Thank you.
It's been a
thank
delight
you.
To be here.
Thank you. Where are the stamps?
Yeah, they've been sold.
Yeah, they sold.